You are listening to Ellie on an Island, Episode 3, The Namesake. Hi everyone, happy Valentine's Day to those who celebrate. Welcome to this new episode. My name is Ellie. I'm an aspiring writer based in Montreal. It's 0 degrees here today, which qualifies as warm. Enjoy the weather if you live somewhere warmer. I hope you like today's episode and decide to read the book yourself. The book we're going to talk about today has been one of my favorite books for a decade, and I'm both excited and honored to share it with you. If you've left the place you used to call home to settle down somewhere else, if you haven't done so yourself but are curious to know what it's like, if you'd like to know more about second-generation immigrants, if you want to see what it's like to live in New York or on the East Coast US, this book will be of interest to you. The title of the book is The Namesake. It's written by Jhumpa Lahiri. She's a celebrated author and a professor of creative writing at Princeton. Her literary agent was Eric Simonoff, the Eric Simonoff. Lahiri won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction for her book, The Interpreter of Maladies. The Namesake was initially published by Mariners Books in 2003. It's been adapted into a film. I read the book first in Farsi, then in English, and when preparing today's episode, I listened to it again on Audible from Amazon. Similar to The Midnight Library and The Maid, it's not part of the Plus catalog. Unfortunately, you have to use your 1 monthly credit to purchase it. It was 10 hours, 10 minutes long, and was narrated by Sarita Chiduri. She does a great job of narrating the book, especially in the second half of the book. But then I came across a video on YouTube of Jhumpa Lahiri reading parts of the book herself at the John Adams Institute in the Netherlands. She does such an exceptional job that it made me wonder why she hasn't done this herself. I compared the two versions, and even the meaning and tone of the book change between her own reading and the one by Sarita. Jhumpa reads it faster, but her soft-spoken voice makes the book cozier and lovelier. Usually authors read their books better than anyone else, to be fair. Think about it this way. There are parts that make the audience laugh in Jhumpa's reading, but didn't come across as funny in Sarita's reading. Anyway, if you're not an audiobook kind of person, you don't need to worry about this. I'm just suggesting an audiobook with this author's voice would be lovely. Something about pronouncing the names. In the Farsi translation, I read that Lahiri prefers to be called Jhumpa, but in the interviews, I heard both Jhumpa and Jhumpa. This goes for the rest of the names in the book as well. Forgive me for butchering the names. Due to the complicated role of immigration in the story of my own life, immigration is a theme I'm interested in and fascinated by. All my life, I unsuccessfully searched to see a bit of myself in a book. This book holds a special part in my heart because this was, believe it or not, the very first book that resonated with me. Immigration is a subject strongly influenced by political parties and elections. Here, she doesn't touch on this aspect at all. There are wonderful books out there about the story of refugees, people who can't go back to the place they call home, the effect of politics on immigration, and rags-to-riches tales. But I see few books echoing the story of educated, highly skilled, dual citizen immigrants. This came up in her interviews and book discussions as well. Some people don't like Lahiri's plain style of writing. I'm the biggest fan of it. Her descriptions show her excellent command of the English language, and I truly enjoy reading her work. Jhumpa Lahiri, thank you for your wonderful book and your beautiful prose. The Namesake starts from the birth of a boy in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and continues until his adulthood, until the age of 32. His Indian father, Ashok Ganguly, is doing a PhD in electrical engineering at MIT. Ashok is hardworking, honest, and studious. He adapts well. Generally speaking, he likes America. He makes a short trip to India and marries a young lady named Ashima. They decide to wed over the course of one afternoon. She's asked to recite a few stanzas of The Daffodil. They ask her whether she's willing to fly on a plane and then if she's capable of living in a city characterized by severe snowy winters. That's how simple it was. He brings Ashima back to America. This is, of course, at a time when immigration was a whole lot easier. Ashima experiences America differently since she stays at home. She's homesick. She longs for India, spending her days looking at pictures of her family, thinking about them, rereading books or magazines in Bengali she's brought with herself, and writing letters to family. Similar to pregnancy, she views America as a place of transit, as her temporary home, the opposite of Ashok. After 18 months of her arrival, she's at the Mount Auburn Hospital to deliver her baby. The book starts here. This is August 1968, where the fathers weren't allowed in the delivery room. They'd sit in the hallway and wait for the nurse to tell them the baby was born and whether it was a boy or a girl. Only three visitors come to the hospital to see the baby boy: Maya and Dilip Nandi, a young married couple in Cambridge whom Ashok and Ashima met a few months ago in the Purity Supreme, and Dr. Gupta, a mathematics postdoc, a bachelor in his 50s, whom Ashok had befriended in the corridors of MIT. Maya and Dilip give the boy a rattle and a baby book. Dr. Gupta gives him a handsome, illustrated book of Mother Goose rhymes. Now see how differently Ashok and Ashima view the baby boy. Ashok, a book lover, remarks, "Lucky boy," turning the beautifully sewn pages of the book, only hours old and already the owner of books, and thinks about the difference between his son's childhood and the one he had known. Ashima feels pity for the boy. She's never known a person entering the world so alone, so deprived. Their three visitors are only substitutes for the people who really ought to be there. Without a single grandparent or uncle or aunt on her side, she feels this is unreal. This sums up how differently they view life in America. As for the name of the baby boy, Ashok and Ashima have decided to let Ashima's grandmother name him. She's named her six other great-grandchildren and is past 80. She writes two names in a letter, one for a boy, one for a girl. She walks herself with her cane to the post office. No one else knows the names. But the letter gets lost and never makes it to Cambridge. Ashima and Ashok don't take naming too seriously. Their tradition is to have a pet name, used by family members and friends, and another proper name, a good name, that will be used in public, usually given at the age a person starts formal education at school. Their explanation doesn't make sense to Mr. Wilcox, the hospital birth certificate compiler. The hospital, naturally, won't release the baby until a name is given. Mr. Wilcox says the only solution if they don't have a name yet is to call him Baby Boy Ganguly and later on go to court and change his name. Although he doesn't recommend this. He suggests naming him after someone in the family, which they consider very rude. They don't have a choice. They desperately need a name. Ashok comes up with a name that has a significant meaning to him. Goggle. Now, why is Goggle important to Ashok? Because he was saved by the book The Overcoat by Nikolai Gogol, the famous Russian author. Years ago, at the age of 22, Ashok was on a train going from Calcutta to Jamshedpur, where his grandfather had retired to. He was a professor of European languages. He had gone blind and asked Ashok, the book lover among his grandchildren, to come and read The State Man, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy to him, and was going to give him all his books collected in a lifetime, kept in a glass front case preserved under lock and key. Ashok had two suitcases with him, one containing his clothes, another one empty to bring back all those books. Ashok meets a man named Ghosh on the train. He's a businessman returning from England. They have a short conversation, and he says something that sticks in Ashok's mind, although he doesn't initially like it. "Take a pillow and a blanket and see as much of the world as you can. You won't regret it. Before it's too late, while you're free, do yourself a favor and travel the world. One day it'll be too late." At night, other people fall asleep. Ashok stays awake and reads short stories by Nikolai Gogol on the train. At 2:30 a.m., he's still awake. The locomotive engine and the seven bogies derail from the broad gauge line. Let's read page 17 and 18. The sound was like a bomb exploding. The first four bogies capsized into a depression alongside the track. The fifth and sixth, containing the first class and air-conditioned passengers, telescoped into each other, killing the passengers in their sleep. The seventh, where Ashok was sitting, capsized as well, flung by the speed of a crash farther into the field. The accident occurred 209 kilometers from Kolkata, between the Gachala and Dolbomgarh stations. The train guard's portable phone would not work. It was only after the guard ran nearly 5 kilometers from the site of the accident to Gachala that he was able to transmit the first message for help. Over an hour passed before the rescuers arrived, bearing lanterns and shovels and axes to pry bodies from the cars. Ashok can still remember their shouts, asking if anyone was alive. He remembers trying to shout back, unsuccessfully, his mouth emitting nothing but the faintest rasp. He remembers the sound of people, half dead around him, moaning and tapping on the walls of the train, whispering hoarsely for help, words that only those who were also trapped and injured could possibly hear. Blood drenched his chest and the right arm of his shirt. He'd been thrust partway out the window. He remembers being unable to see anything at all. For the first hours, he thought that perhaps, like his grandfather, whom he was on his way to visit, he'd gone blind. He remembers the acrid odor of flames, the buzzing of flies, children crying, the taste of dust and blood on his tongue. They were nowhere, somewhere in a field. Milling about them were villagers, police inspectors, a few doctors. He remembers believing that he was dying, that perhaps he was already dead. He couldn't feel the lower half of his body, and so was unaware that the mangled limbs of Ghosh were draped over his legs. Eventually, he saw the cold, unfriendly blue of earliest morning, the moon and a few stars still lingering in the sky. The pages of his book, which had been tossed from his hand, fluttered in two sections a few feet away from the train. The glare from a search lantern briefly caught the pages, momentarily distracting one of the rescuers. "Nothing here," Ashok heard someone say. "Let's keep going." But the lantern's light lingered, just long enough for Ashok to raise his hand, a gesture that he believed would consume the small fragment of life left in him. He was still clutching a single page of the overcoat, crumbled tightly in his fist, and when he raised his hand, the wad of paper dropped from his fingers. "Wait," he heard a voice cry out. "The fellow by that book, I saw him move." His pelvis and right femur were crushed, and he broke 3 ribs. While recovering, he thought about what Ghosh had said to him. "Pack a pillow and a blanket and see as much of the world as you can." He envisions a different future for himself, not only walking, but walking away as far as he can. The train wreck is initially paralyzing, subsequently inspiring. He doesn't tell his family about his plans until he has a fellowship and a passport and is ready to go. Now back to the hospital. The baby boy is named Goggle, and the parents intend to give him the good name later on. Ashima's grandmother suffers a stroke and loses most of her memory. She doesn't remember Ashima, let alone the name she'd written herself. Her father tells Ashima to prepare herself for her death. Ashima is an exhausted first-time mother. She thinks she's not capable of raising a child all by herself, but she actually learns to do so. They prepare for their first trip to India with Goggle. She goes shopping and spends all the money she has on buying modest presents for all family members, more expensive items for the fathers. On the subway back home, when struggling to get the stroller out in time, she forgets the bags full of presents, and she doesn't know what to do. She's devastated. She doesn't have money to go and buy new ones. That night, Ashok calls the MBTA Lost and Found, and the next day, all her bags are delivered to them. It's the first time she likes something about this place, despite all its rules. This small miracle makes her feel connected to Cambridge. She's proud that she has a story to say at dinner parties. "Only in America," other people say. Before their trip, her father suddenly passes away from a heart attack, and they go earlier than expected. Goggle's childhood, which is explained in detail, is the best part of the book. Lahiri does an exceptional job here. Ashima's life is centered around Goggle and later on her daughter. Their family friends grow, and they go to dinners on Saturday nights. This part is similar to the Persian culture. The parents converse in Bengali and have Bengali food while the kids speak in English among themselves and have pizza or Chinese food and watch TV. Ashok has become a professor at a university outside Boston. They buy a Toyota Corolla, but Ashima doesn't want to drive. Shortly after, they buy a house in the town, which is a major achievement for them, a shingle two-story colonial in a recently built development. They came to America each with a single suitcase, and now they own a piece of this land. Ashok changes his views on what to buy and how things should be done. They buy from yard sales. Ashok, accustomed to wearing tailor-made pants and shirts all his life, buys ready-made, and he stops wearing his watch since there's a clock everywhere. Pages 63 to 65 illustrate this change. Now it's time for Goggle to start kindergarten. They ask the school to call him Nikhil, which is a good Bengali name and has a connection to Goggle. The problem is that Goggle doesn't respond to Nikhil. He thinks he's being asked to be someone else. The school respects the wish of Goggle and decides to call him so. His sister is born. This time, the parents are prepared and know the best way is to do away with the pet name altogether. His sister is named Sonali or Shonali, and after several nicknames, Sonia. Sonia is generally more laid back and less pensive than Goggle. As a young boy, Goggle's name doesn't bother him. He sees pieces of himself in road signs. Go left, go right, go slow. Goggle is at sixth grade that the peculiarity of his name becomes apparent to him. The class goes on a field trip of historical intent. They visit the house of a poet and then they go to a graveyard and are handed newsprint and thick crayons. They put the newsprint on top of the gravestones and rub the surfaces of the stones using the crayons. The names on the stones have faded because it's so old. He takes the newsprint and rubs with the side of his crayon. At first, nothing happens. Then the name magically appears. Abijah Craven, 1701-1745. He thinks about the name he's brought to life. He doesn't know if it's a name for a man or a woman, or how to pronounce it. He keeps doing this and sees other uncommon, flamboyant names. A chaperone walks by and remarks that those names are sort of like his. He finds this interesting, that other people with strange names lived here before, and realizes that names too perish, just like humans. He feels that these ancient Puritan spirits, these very first immigrants to America, these bearers of unthinkable obsolete names, have spoken to him. It's a meaningful experience for him. The parents make an effort to keep Goggle and Sonia Bengali, despite their American accents and haircuts. They attend Bengali language and culture classes every other Saturday. For his 14th birthday, his father gives him a book by Nikolai Gogol. Gogol doesn't look at the book. He somehow hates his name. And I had a hard time wrapping my head around this abomination. In one part, Gogol says, "No one takes me seriously because of my name." His father responds, "You're the only one not taking you seriously." For those of you who don't know me, Ellie is the anglicized version of my own name, but I don't have a problem with my name. All my life, everyone's been very respectful. Yes, I spell it, much like Ashima does, but it's for simplicity's sake that I go with Ellie. Once, the instructor at a career development workshop was trying to read my name, and I jumped in saying he could call me Ellie. He cleverly said, "You don't need to change your name to make life easier for the English-speaking part of the world." That was quite the statement. That's why I believe Goggle's name problem is symbolic. There is a conflict of values that's bothering him. Goggle goes to high school. He's an outstanding student, curious and cooperative. In his sophomore year, Ashok goes on sabbatical and they go to India for 8 months. They miss the second semester of school. In India, they experience a different life. They don't rent an apartment of their own. Instead, they stay at houses of relatives. I felt for the kids here to take two kids, one in high school and another one in sixth grade, to another country without giving them anything to do, without considering their well-being is not something most people would approve of. What were they expecting these poor kids to do all those months? Once they visit the Taj Mahal and experience a different India, an India where they speak English and use forks and spoons, the kids have a fun time over there. I wish the parents had done more of that stuff with the kids. Gogol rightfully wishes for trips and more memories with family in his adulthood. Gogol attends Yale. Again, Lahiri masterfully executes his growth and change. He's so conscious about his name that he changes his name to Nikhil by going to court. He takes a drawing class without telling his parents, because they consider drawing frivolous at this stage of life, in spite of Ashima's father being an artist. They expect him to become a doctor, an engineer, a lawyer, telling him it's these professions that have brought them to America and have guaranteed them security and respect. He smokes marijuana and camel lights. By mistake, Gogol, or Nikhil, once calls his dorm room home. Ashima gets outraged by this remark, dwelling on it all day. She's lived in this country for 20 years, yet she doesn't consider it her home. He's only been to Yale a few months and now calls it home. He goes home every weekend by train. His father always comes to see him off and pick him up. It's here that he tells him the significance of his name, Gogol. Nikhil, or Gogol, is touched and feels enormous love from his father. "Does my name remind you of all this?" Gogol asks. Ashok responds, "No, you remind me of everything that followed." I love this about Ashok here. Most people would have talked about something that tragic all day, every day. He's kept it a secret from his son for 20 years. He meets a girl he likes, Ruth, but they break up after she returns from England in his senior year. He graduates from the architecture program at Columbia, even though he was accepted to MIT as well. But after 4 years in New Haven, he didn't want to move back to Massachusetts, to the one city in America his parents know. He didn't want to attend his father's alma mater and live in an apartment in Central Square as his parents once had, and revisit the streets about which his parents speak nostalgically. He didn't want to go home on the weekends, to go with them to pujos and Bengali parties, to remain unquestionably in their world. He lives in New York. He finds a job at a large architecture firm in Midtown. He's a bit stiff, perpetually upset. His colleague invites him to a party. There, he sees an attractive young lady named Maxine Ratliff. She has dirty blonde hair gathered sloppily into a bun, strands falling randomly. She has green eyes, and when she holds her gaze, she makes Gogol feel the absolute center of the world. The next day, she calls and invites Nikhil to her place. She's an only child and lives with her parents in a Greek Revival mansion. Her father, Gerald, is a tall, good-looking man with luxuriant white hair and Maxine's pale green-gray eyes. Her mother, Lydia, is a textile curator for the Metropolitan Museum of Art. For the first date, he essentially has dinner with Maxine's family. Gogol falls for the Ratliffs, for their class, for their elegance, their charm, their sophistication, their manner of living. From the beginning, he's effortlessly incorporated into their lives. Gogol's reaction to the dinner is very much like mine. They make a big fuss over the meal. Let's read page 133. Lydia serves the food on broad white plates, a thin piece of steak rolled into a bundle and tied with string, sitting in a pool of dark sauce, the green beans boiled so that they're still crisp. A bowl of small, round, roasted red potatoes is passed around, and afterward a salad. They eat appreciatively, commenting on the tenderness of the meat, the freshness of the beans. His own mother would never have served so few dishes to a guest. She would have kept her eyes trained on Maxine's plate, insisting she have seconds and thirds. The table would have been lined with a row of serving bowls so that people could help themselves. But Lydia pays no attention to Gogol's plate. She makes no announcement indicating that there is more. The four of them go quickly through two bottles of wine, then move on to a third. The Ratliffs are vociferous at the table, opinionated about things his own parents are indifferent to. Movies, exhibits at museums, good restaurants, the design of everyday things. They speak of New York, of stores and neighborhoods and buildings they either despise or love, with an intimacy and ease that makes Goggle feel as if he barely knows the city. They speak about the house which Gerald and Lydia bought back in the 70s, when no one wanted to live in the area, about the history of the neighborhood, and about Clement Clark Moore, who Gerald explains was a professor of classics at the seminary across the street. He was the person responsible for local residential zoning, Gerald says. That, in writing, 'twas the night before Christmas, of course. Goggle is unaccustomed to this sort of talk at mealtimes, to the indulgent ritual of the lingering meal, and the pleasant aftermath of bottles and crumbs and empty glasses that clutter the table. Something tells him that none of this is for his benefit, that this is the way the Radcliffes eat every night. Gerald is a lawyer. Lydia is a curator of textiles at the Met. They're at once satisfied and intrigued by his background, by his years at Yale and Columbia, his career as an architect, his Mediterranean looks. You could be Italian, Lydia remarks at one point during the meal, regarding him in the candle's glow. When the talk at the dinner table eventually turns to India, they ask questions other people don't. They ask about the rise of Hindu fundamentalism, Indian carpets and miniatures, about a spectacular palace built on a lake in Udaipur, the Victorian architecture of Calcutta. The Radcliffes are generous, but don't go out of their way to accommodate others. Goggle and Maxine go shopping on Madison Avenue at stores they must be buzzed into. For cashmere cardigans and outrageously expensive English colognes, Maxine buys without deliberation or guilt. They go to humble-looking restaurants downtown where the tables are tiny, the bills huge. Nevertheless, Maxine's biggest gift is not the private schools or the mansion, but accepting her life the way it is. She never wished she were anyone else other than herself, raised in any other place, in any other way. She respects her parents' choice and taste and treats them like friends. There's no sense of obligation. Unlike his parents, they pressure her to do nothing, yet she lives faithfully and happily at their side. In summertime, they collectively go to the lake house in New Hampshire. Ashima calls Goggle and almost demands that he come down and visit them, since Ashok will be going all by himself to Cleveland to work on a corporate research project for 9 months. He hasn't visited them in a while. Ashima now works at the library and will be staying. Sonia lives in California. Goggle accepts to stop by with Maxine on the way. I felt for both Goggle and his parents here. His mother spent a day cooking and preparing food too rich for the weather. Around the table, they can't have a conversation the way the Radcliffes can. His parents have a perpetual fear of disaster which gets on his nerves. The Radcliffes have a sense of security and confidence they lack. He's relieved when they leave. His father's last words are, "Remember to check in on your mother now and again." In this part, they go to the lake house. He gets as far from his parents as he can get. He thinks about how he's never had a proper vacation. The trips they've taken to Chicago or Toronto or India didn't qualify as vacation. I felt so bad for him. This is important advice to parents. Make sure to make memories with your children. There is a mention of Montreal in this book. Yay! The lake house they spend the summer in with the Radcliffe family is located close to Canada, and Maxine suggests they go visit Montreal. It just makes me so happy to see mentions of the place I live in. They return to New York. Maxine and Goggle are returning home from a book party. His mother and sister have called the Radcliffe several times to talk to Goggle and inform him that his father has passed away. This part was moving. His father died all by himself in a hospital in Cleveland from a heart attack. To see the death of a hard-working person at that age saddens me every time I read it. Nikhil shaves his head as a sign of mourning in the Bengali culture. After that, he returns to New York, but soon breaks up with Maxine. The death of his father draws him closer to his family. He greatly misses him. Ashima urges him to move on with his life and meet someone. After a year, his mother calls him and asks if he remembers a little girl named Moshimi from childhood. Moshimi is a PhD candidate in French literature at NYU. They meet. This part made me feel like I lived in New York. Hats off to the author. Goggle and Moshimi soon get married. Soon after, Moshimi grows tired of their married life. She has friends, Astrid and Donald, who strongly influence her. I'm going to read from pages 235 and 236 here. Donald and Astrid are a languidly confident couple, a model, Goggle guesses, for how Moshimi would like their own lives to be. They reach out to people, hosting dinner parties, bequeathing little bits of themselves to their friends. They're passionate spokespeople for their brand of life, giving Goggle and Moshimi a steady, unquestionable stream of advice about quotidian things. They swear by a certain bakery on Sullivan Street, a certain butcher on Mott, a certain style of coffee maker, a certain Florentine designer of sheets for the bed. Their decrees drive Goggle crazy, but Moshimi is loyal. She regularly goes out of her way, and thus out of their budget, to buy bread at that bakery, meat at that butcher. And somehow, whenever they return from their place, she's gloomy. Moshimi has a lot of baggage. She has a self-esteem problem, in my opinion. And she starts an affair with another man. Goggle and Moshimi both had sought in each other something wrong. She associates him with a sense of resignation, with the very life she had resisted. He had saved her from her previous marriage disaster. Yet he had acted on the same impulse. You'll have to read this part yourself to understand what's going on with the characters. In the end, Goggle is returning home for Christmas. He's divorced now. They're selling the house because Ashima will be spending 6 months in India and 6 months in the States. Ashima now thinks her kids are right about not giving in for less than their ideal happiness. She wishes she'd taken more time when deciding her own marriage, not just one afternoon. The ending is beautiful but sad. You can see the change in the characters, their growth, but it could have been a little less gloomy. I guess the moral is, sooner than you expect, your kids are going to be all grown up and moving out. You're going to miss it so much. Don't take a moment for granted. This was it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Let me know if you decide to read the book yourself. Please subscribe to my CastBox and Apple Podcast channel and to my Instagram account. They're all Ellie on an Island. I will talk to you in my next episode. Bye!